May it please the Court, my name is Robert Hennick, and I represent Iran Evans on this appeal. As demonstrated in the briefs, there are a number of reasons why the original trial in this matter cannot be relied upon as a reliable assessment of Mr. Evans' guilt or innocence. Before addressing those issues, however, the State has raised another claim, basically that Mr. Evans should be deprived of the opportunity to challenge the validity of his conviction while being assisted by counsel. For a number of reasons, the State's argument is just wrong. First, the State has given no reason for its either 5 or 9 or 22-month delay in raising these kind of claims. The motion to extend the time for this appeal was filed in March of 2002. The Court of Appeals decided it 2 days later. Under 809.14(2), the State had 11 days without an extension to file a response, to object if they didn't agree with the motion and the result. Obviously, under 802.82, if that 11-day period was insufficient, the court could have moved the court of, or the state could have moved the Court of Appeals for a further extension, so they could raise whatever objections or challenges they wished to raise. Instead, the state waited 5 months before raising its first objection, that this should have been a motion under a Knight habeas petition rather than a motion to extend time.
Mr. Hennick, I'm curious, why didn't you bring a Knight habeas petition rather than the motion for extension of time?
We could have brought a Knight petition. I chose to bring the motion to extend time because I believed it was a much more streamlined, efficient way of handling this kind of issue. If good cause is not limited to the kind of issues that you can raise on a Knight petition, my client is not rich, the $150 at that time filing fee would have been, if not prohibitive, at least would have been expensive to them. I also figured that since a motion to extend time is only decided by a one-judge panel, if the judge in his discretion decided not to grant it, then we would still be free to file a habeas petition if we wanted to, if we thought that there were reasons.
Do you think this approach defeats the Knight petition requirements? In other words, if we allow this approach to be taken, are we causing problems in terms of the procedure that's been developed with the Knight habeas petitions?
Not at all. No. As a matter of fact, if you accept the state's argument, then I believe that there will be more problems than we have now under the current procedure. Under the current procedure, you can make a motion to extend time under 809.82 for good cause. And that includes anything. Under Harris, this court said that that includes errors of counsel, errors of the clerk's office. It doesn't have to be a constitutional violation. If we accept the state's argument and say that anything or any time that you're requesting an extension of time based on an error of counsel has to be made as a Knight petition, we're going to be shifting. The Harris-type case would have to have been a Knight petition. We'd have to shift a number of things from the simple streamlined motion procedure under 809.14 to the more complex procedure and time-consuming procedure of a Knight petition. I don't think that is efficient. We're basically hitting, using a cannon to take care of a fly. If there are particular problems in particular cases, for instance, the state mentions that there may be a need for a hearing, an evidentiary hearing in a case where the state actually submits that there is a problem with factual allegations. The procedure under 809.82 allows the judge in the Court of Appeals to deny the motion, saying, I think this needs to be brought as a Knight petition. In a sound exercise of the court's discretion, he or she can do that. The state's proposal here would require every case to go through a Knight petition, and I think that that's going to end up hurting judicial efficiency. It's going to require more time by the courts. It's going to require more time by litigants in cases, especially such as this, where there is no real dispute as to the facts. I do not believe that there is any requirement in Knight or any decision by this court that says that a case such as this has to be brought by a habeas petition. There's no ineffective assistance or denial of counsel exception written into 809.82. When the court decided Knight, it was focusing on the forum rather than the particular procedure that is used to challenge the effectiveness of counsel. An 809.82 motion obviously is decided by the Court of Appeals, so we have the proper forum, we have the proper remedy, and I don't see any reason that that should be changed. The state's assertion that this is a successive, that this motion is a successive motion, again, is just wrong. Under Knight and the Court of Appeals decision in Smalley, a challenge to the effectiveness of appellate counsel cannot be raised in the trial court by a 974-06 motion. So there has not been a prior motion by Mr. Evans in which he could have raised the ineffectiveness of appellate counsel. And finally, there is the state raised for the first time in its brief to this court that, although again not giving any reason why it took 22 months to raise this, that in fact there was no waiver of the right to counsel, or that there was in fact an effective waiver of the right to counsel back in 1997.
Doesn't the state raise, I guess my question under 809.82, which is asking for an extension of time, when you look at this case particularly where your client was represented by counsel originally and then there was a debate as to whether what avenue they should take himself pro se, there was a couple of extensions of time, and then at least under 974-06, the Escalano issue, these very issues, some of these issues could have been raised, and the state is raising the issue that isn't this a way to get around the 974 requirements? My question is to, I understand he's retained counsel, you're asking, or there was a 6-year hiatus here between the time, when this was first brought, and, you're coming into the case.
First of all, it was a 4.5-year hiatus between the deadline, the last deadline for filing the appeal, and the time that I filed the motion. I know that the state says 6 years. I think they're confused. It's 6 years from the conviction, but it's 4.5 years. I'm not saying that makes a whole lot of difference. If it's unreasonable at 6 years, it's probably unreasonable at 4.5. But it's not unreasonable. The reason it's not unreasonable is because the United States Supreme Court in Coleman v. Thompson and in Murray v. Currier, as explained in the briefs, held that when the state does not ensure that the defendant is provided with the right to counsel on appeal, then any defaults made by the defendant when he is not represented by counsel are imputed to the state, not to him. So that if, as in this case, the defendant was denied his right to counsel, he ended up proceeding pro se without a valid waiver on appeal, his defaults, any mistakes that he made in the 974-06 petition have to be imputed to the state, not
that,
to him.
That begs the question, though. There's never been a determination that there was fault on the part of counsel here.
I am not alleging ineffectiveness of counsel. I'm alleging denial of counsel, which is two separate things. And
there hasn't been a finding in either event, as I understand the record.
Right. And the reason why we are here and why the motion was made, actually, I would disagree with that. I believe that the Court of Appeals, in granting the extension motion, which was based on ineffectiveness of counsel, I believe that that is a finding of ineffectiveness.
But one sentence? Granting an enlargement of time?
Yes, based on the motion, which the motion specifically was based solely on on the denial of counsel. And
the court did not substantively address that issue.
I would respectfully disagree. When a court issues a decision based on a claim that is made and the only argument that is made is one argument, It can be assumed that the court made the finding that the argument is in fact true and accurate. And especially in a case such as this where there is no finding or there was no opposition until some 5 minutes later, that
there was no solicitation of a response or an opportunity for a response from the state. The court entered its one-sentence order granting the motion for enlargement of time 2 days after it was filed.
Yes, and there was every opportunity for the state to respond under 809.14 sub 2, which specifically says that when there is a procedural decision that is made without receiving a response, that the opposing party has an opportunity to respond within 11 days. That can be extended if the party thinks they need additional time. The state has never suggested that it had good cause for not objecting. The state conceded that it received the order shortly after it was entered. The state concedes that it received the motion at the time that it was served. So the state had every opportunity to actually raise that at the time. It chose not to.
Well, the state had an opportunity to seek reconsideration of the decision on the motion to enlarge time pursuant to the rule that you've just cited. Didn't do so.
Right.
Some months later came in and asked for a clarification of just exactly what sort of procedural posture this case was now in, since, as I understand it, it is unprecedented for 809.82 to be used to grant a 4.5-year enlargement of time after the fact. And so it was, I think, not entirely unreasonable to ask for a clarification if this is exactly what the court intended to do. And then, as I understand the record, also the court indicated that the state would have an opportunity to brief the procedural issue once the case was in briefing. Is that right?
What the Court of Appeals held is that, well, at that point, the state objected that it should have been a night petition rather than 809.82. The Court of Appeals, as I recall, held that denied the motion for clarification, said, first of all, that it was clear that the purpose of it was to, in fact, reopen the direct appeal, and that the state could brief whether or not the Court of Appeals had the authority to do that in its brief. It was free to do that. What the state has done, in addition to its night argument, which is, I believe, unprecedented, is to argue as well that the Court of Appeals, although they have the authority to do it, that they abuse their discretion by granting the extension. I think that's a bit beyond what the Court of Appeals authorized in response to the clarification motion. But the bottom line is that they didn't do anything for 5 months. They could have done it earlier before we went back, relying on the Court of Appeals decision, to the circuit court, filed the post-conviction motion in the circuit court. The circuit court decided the motion. We did a supplemental motion in the circuit court based on new evidence. The state didn't do anything until after we had gone through that entire process. And then they threw up their hands and said, oh, wait a second, we want to go back to square one.
Is there any precedent for using 809.82, the statute that pertains to enlargement of time, to wage a collateral attack on a judgment long since final?
Well, first of all, it's the reopening the appeal is not a collateral attack on the judgment. What it is reopening the appeal or extending the time. And
well, the appeal lapsed, and so the judgment became final. Isn't that right?
The
appeal time expired, and when that happens, the judgment is final. And so this has to constitute a collateral attack on that judgment, because we're now 6 years hence, and at the time the motion was filed, 4.5 years hence. So it is a form of collateral attack.
It is not an attack on the judgment, because the argument that is made, the violation that is alleged, is not that the underlying conviction is invalid, but that he is entitled to an appeal. And under 809.82 sub 2, the rule explicitly says that the defendant or that the party seeking an extension of time, the court can grant it even after the time has lapsed. There is nothing in 809.82 that suggests that there is some arbitrary deadline on when that can be made.
But the practice normally is for a motion to enlarge time to be made before the expiration of that time.
Sometimes.
Mostly.
I would not say that. Mostly, in the public defender's office, quite often there are times, I know from my wife Ellen working in the public defender's office and Pat Flood, who is a friend of mine, although, you know, despite this motion, that the practice in the public defender's office, it is quite common that individuals will come in saying, I wanted an appeal, but my lawyer didn't file the notice of intent. This is, you know, can be weeks after the deadline, the 20-day deadline for filing a notice of intent, or even a year or more. They have a special form to give to the individual to request that the form, that the appeal be reopened. So it is quite common to actually move to extend the times after the deadline has passed.
This long after?
I have had one case that was longer than this, yes.
How'd you fare?
No, what I meant is that I've had one case in which it's been granted longer than this. I think it was 5 years in that case.
The motion to enlarge time?
Yes.
If this were made before the expiration of the time and the motion came into the Court of Appeals saying, under 809-82, I hereby move the court for a 4.5-year extension of time, would that be granted?
Most likely not. But
that's unreasonable.
In most cases, yes. I can't imagine a case in which it wouldn't be.
Why is it not unreasonable under these circumstances where 4.5 years ago the time expired and the same motion is now made after the fact? Why isn't that per se unreasonable, not good cause?
It's per se unreasonable because it is a per se violation of the right to counsel, and that any default under Coleman and Murray cannot be imputed to the defendant. It has to be imputed to the state. The reason why, as the Court of Appeals explained in the Court of Appeals decision, is that we cannot assume that a pro se person who has not been given the right to counsel, who has been denied the right to counsel on appeal, knows what his rights are, or even knew that he had been violated in a sense.
But we haven't had any litigation on that issue yet. That was apparently assumed. There hasn't been any litigation of the issue about what happened between attorney and client that caused the appeal time to expire without any appeal being filed.
But that has been litigated. It was litigated in the motion. The Court of Appeals decided it. The state chose not to object to it until long after its time for objecting had expired. And under this court's the same analysis, that motion was final on the 11th day after the order was issued. So if we're talking about...
I understand that the state dropped the ball on that, but how can it have been considered litigated and decided in the space of 2 days based on a one-sided record?
Because it is a procedural order. It doesn't go to the specifics of the appeal, the merits of the appeal. Number two, because the state had an opportunity to respond. It chose not to. Therefore, it waived any factual objection to it.
You've made a very important point here, and this is what troubles me about this whole process. 809-82 is a procedural device, a procedural statute that allows parties in an appeal to obtain an enlargement of time, an extension of time to do whatever the rules require for good cause. It is being used in this context to litigate a substantive claim of denial of counsel or ineffective assistance of counsel, whichever way it's characterized. And that is not appropriate, to use a procedural statute which pertains to enlarging time for good cause. Judge, I can't get this brief done on time for these reasons because I have, you know, this many other briefs to do by the same time. Can I have another 10 days? I mean, that motion, it's directed to a single judge, and the judge can either say that's good cause or that's not good cause as a procedural matter. You're using it to litigate what is a substantive claim of denial or ineffective assistance of counsel, and that's not appropriate under the rules. The Knight case says that that sort of claim should be filed as a habeas in the Court of Appeals. Or the Rothering case says that sort of claim should be filed as a habeas, 974-6, in the trial court if the finger is being pointed at post-conviction counsel instead of appellate counsel.
And this court in Harris held that the issue of whether an attorney screwed up and whether you lost your right to appeal because your attorney made a mistake, that is appropriate under 809-82.
How many days in Harris were we talking about? How many days of lateness?
Unfortunately, I don't recall.
Several days is what the case said.
Okay. Several days.
Not and, 4.5 years.
Right. And there is nothing in 809.82 that sets a deadline. All that it says is that the except as provided in the subsection, for instance, a civil appeal, the court upon its own motion or upon good cause shown by motion may enlarge or reduce the time prescribed by these rules or court order for doing any act or waive or permit an act to be done after the expiration of the prescribed time. There's no deadline there. If we're talking about, there is implicit in that, and in 809.14, the motions rule, an implicit requirement of reasonableness in time. Obviously, this is within the discretion of the court on whether it should be granted. But when we have U.S. Supreme Court decisions in Coleman and Murray saying that errors of counsel are not to be imputed to the defendant when there is a violation of the right to counsel or denial of the right to counsel, that I submit is per se reasonable. And there is no deadline then for filing such a motion because whatever the defendant did, it's imputed to the state. The state doesn't have a right to object because it was the state that's responsible for ensuring that this defendant is protected by the right to counsel and actually is granted the right to counsel unless he validly waives it.
Justice Prosser, go ahead.
I'm not sure I could hear all of Justice Sykes' questions, but here we are. The Supreme Court is going to write a published opinion here. You have used your persuasive skills to get the case here, and you've gotten it here using a procedure that, if it were used once in a while under the radar, it seems to me we could kind of look the other way. But now, basically, you're asking us to ratify opening up everything on appeal, as I understand it, after a 974-06 motion was filed by the client. Am I missing something?
Where there is a pro se 974-06 petition filed by an individual who was denied his constitutional right to counsel on appeal, any defects or any defaults involved in that petition cannot be imputed to him, cannot be used to bar him from his right to a direct appeal with counsel. That's Penson, that's the Court of Appeals, Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals in Betts. I believe that's also the Coleman decision. This is not going to open up the floodgates because, first of all, there has to be a denial of the right to counsel. If there is a denial of the right to counsel, then yes, the defendant is entitled to have an appeal with counsel. If there was no denial of the right to counsel, the defendant is not entitled to such an appeal. So it's not going to be floodgates. The only people that are going to benefit from this are people who have already been denied the right to counsel on appeal. And those individuals are entitled to an appeal with counsel. What should have been done here, given the communication between the Ms. Flood and the defendant, what you should have done is not closed her case, which is meaningless anyway. I close my cases all the time and reopen them when things have to happen on them. But what should have happened is that if you have appointed counsel and your client says he wants to retain a lawyer, you don't close the case. You hold the case open until he actually either has substitute counsel appear or gives you an explicit statement that I want to go pro se. Until there is that kind of a decision, this individual is still entitled to appointed counsel on appeal. And until there is a valid waiver, the attorney should not close the case. And I believe that that's what the court should inform appellate attorneys in the state. And that's what
the Court of Appeals in its per curiam reviewed this and decided that the other panel that decided the extension motion did it reasonably.
Yes.
Okay. And that they viewed it as you do, that they made a decision on the merits of that motion.
Yes.
Now that your time has expired, in 3 minutes flat, suppose you managed to win on that point. Where does it get you?
Where it gets me, it should get me a new trial.
Okay, and on what basis? Rattle
basis.
It off.
One, the Court of Appeals is absolutely correct that the trial court erred in denying the lesser-included offense instruction.
Okay.
That's because in a case like this, where the shots are fired from very close range, in this case 3 to 4 feet, the jury can infer that the defendant is actually intending to shoot where the shots hit, in this case the arm, the leg, not vital areas. Under Terrell and Hawthorne.
Jury question. Not the evidence to go to the jury.
Yes.
Okay.
Number two, the issue of whether the trial court should have excluded defense witnesses as to Mr. Evans' whereabouts on the day of the shooting. I believe that the state and the trial court got bogged down in a definitional dispute of whether this is technically an alibi because the individuals, the witnesses, could not specify exactly where they were, exactly where Evans was at the exact time of the shooting. They could say where he was throughout the day, but they couldn't say exactly where he was at 3:15 in the afternoon that day. That I believe that the by getting bogged down in whether this is an alibi or not misses the point. The point is whether this evidence is relevant, whether this evidence makes it more likely than not that Evans, in fact, is telling the truth when he says that he's somewhere else at the time.
Did they introduce other evidence that would indicate he was somewhere else? I mean, so that this was redundant, you know, that's always the...
Yeah, his own testimony.
Okay. All right.
The evidence of Gail Jarrett, the mother, she testified, but it was stricken. And under this court's decision in Burroughs, when a defendant gives an alibi or what says that he's somewhere else at the time, if he doesn't produce the witnesses who he says he was with, the jury naturally assumes that he's not telling the truth. Third, an issue of whether the trial court should have decided whether, in fact, the alleged statement was falsified by the officer.
Well, didn't you put in some evidence on that?
Put in some evidence at trial, but our position is that under, for instance, this court's decisions in Samuel, the U.S. Supreme Court decisions in Miller v. Pate, the state is prevented as a matter of due process from submitting evidence which, in fact, is false. In this case, and under Kyles v. Whitley...
Well, isn't that an issue for the jury, whether this confession that was inserted on a blank page that he signed is false?
It is also an issue for the jury, but I think as a first impression or a first decision, the trial court has an obligation to make that decision. Under Miller v. Pate, the jury made the decision that the underwear, in fact, had blood on it rather than paint, but that didn't bar the defendant from challenging it.
Okay.
Number four is whether the trial court erred in denying this or in quashing the subpoena deuces tecum for Detective Jones's prior statements. He testified that this statement is true and accurate. I wrote down what Evans told me, and I know it's kind of strange. I didn't have him sign immediately under the statement, but that's the way I always handle it. The defendant had issued a subpoena deuces tecum. The detective ignored it. And the judge denied it, saying it was irrelevant whether the explanation given by the detective was in fact accurate or not.
You've got a fifth?
Discovery, post-conviction discovery. We learned through an open records request that this agent, which it was testimony the state relied on so heavily, in fact had been punished with a 25-day suspension without pay for untruthfulness. We believe that that is, we sought to get the underlying records for that. All we got was the end result.
Did you impeach him with this at trial?
No, because that was not available at trial.
All right. Six.
That the combined effect of denying relevant evidence of Noel Marshall and Gail Jarrett, the 25-day suspension, all of that combined meant that the real controversy had not been tried.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You'll get about a minute and a half in rebuttal. Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin.
Good morning. Thank you, Your Honor. I'm Assistant Attorney General James Freimuth, representing the state of Wisconsin. As cross-petitioner, the state asks this court to reverse that part of the Court of Appeals decision that has granted Defendant Evans a new trial on the attempted homicide conviction and to reinstate that conviction. As respondent, the state asks this court to affirm that part of the Court of Appeals decision that affirms the Evans conviction of first-degree reckless injury while armed. Specifically, the state asks this court to hold as follows, and I have 4 points I'll try to get through quickly. First, Evans' direct appeal should not have been reinstated, regardless of whether an extension motion could be used to allege loss of direct appeal on the basis of ineffective appellate counsel. There are three reasons under this first reason. I'll just summarize them quickly at the beginning. First is procedural default. Evans did not provide a sufficient reason for not bringing his claim of ineffective appellate counsel before he brought his prior 97406 motion. Secondly, or alternatively, Evans should be held to have waived or forfeited his direct appeal by waiting 6 years to complain about its absence, 4.5 years after the time ran, 6 years from trial, without good reason for waiting that long. And the third alternative under why the direct appeal should not have been reinstated, the record shows that Evans did knowingly and voluntarily waive his right to direct appeal with counsel back in 1996-97. At the very least, a predicate hearing should have been held before Evans' direct appeal was reinstated. The second point follows from the first, and that is that because Evans' direct appeal should not have been reinstated, Evans is left with only a second successive collateral post-conviction effort. Evans' claim of instructional error is not cognizable on a collateral post-conviction review or effort because it is not of constitutional or jurisdictional dimension. In fact, that's what the Court of Appeals said when Evans raised this in his first 97406 motion. The third point, Evans' remaining claims, although constitutional in nature, should not be reached. Either they were properly resolved against Evans on his first 97406 motion, or if they are new, again, Evans has not explained why he failed to bring them on his first 97406 motion. And the fourth point is in the alternative, and that is this court could alternatively deny all of Evans' claims, either for lack of merit or lack of prejudice.
Harmless error.
I'm sorry?
Harmless
Correct.
Error.
Correct. Okay. Or in the context of his ineffective counsel claim, lack of prejudice. From the state's perspective, the key issue is the one that has dominated the discussion so far, and that is the alleged instructional error on which Evans' attempted homicide conviction was reversed based on the reinstatement of his direct appeal 4.5 to 6 years after the fact. This court should hold that Evans' direct appeal should not have been reinstated for the three reasons that I summarized. And the first is the procedural default one.
First is the procedural what?
Default. Procedural default, I'm sorry. Evans' extension motion is a procedural vehicle, for one thing, and our case law says that when you have a claim of ineffective appellate counsel, it should be brought by habeas petition. The cases Knight and Flores, Smalley, don't say it's the exclusive method of doing so, but it's the proper method for doing so because it cannot be granted as a supervisory writ without giving the state a chance to respond to it. The need for the state to respond to it is because this type of situation, these procedural default waiver arguments, cannot realistically be made in a short amount of time without giving the state a chance to talk to the appellate counsel being accused of ineffectiveness, without developing a record on that. That's the problem with the extension motion. I don't know why the state did not respond immediately, either in the first 2 days when the motion was granted or immediately thereafter.
I suppose they had brought a habeas.
Yes.
Then what would your argument be?
If we were asked to respond, habeas could be denied ex parte, but if we were asked to respond, we would probably be making the arguments that I'm making now.
So that's my point to the question. You'd be exactly where you are now.
Right. We would be making those arguments. But I think that the problem, the way this case got off track, was by the extension motion. And my suspicion is that when it was captioned as a motion to extend time, our office normally doesn't oppose extension motions to file a notice of appeal. My guess is that because of the way it was captioned, not a lot of thought went into looking at the reasons for it, and it wasn't responded to. Until it was noticed down the road 5 months later, when the motion to reconsider, to stay the appellate record, the defense had made a motion to reconsider a predicate post-conviction motion in the trial court. Then it was noticed that this is so long after the fact, and not only that, but there had been a prior 974-06 motion that had been filed. There are 2 points, I guess, on this topic that I'd like the court to think about holding that may help clear up the procedure here.
Okay.
The first is that, and this deals with also the procedural default aspect, the fact that there had been a 974-06 burst. Unless there is a sufficient reason to the contrary, a convicted defendant's complaint about the absence of a direct appeal should always be brought before the defendant pursues any other collateral post-conviction action, and it should be brought by habeas petition. And I'll give you 3 reasons why I say that in just a second, but let me just tell you the other second proposition.
So repeat that. Unless sufficient reason to the contrary, a complaint.
You want me to repeat that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry. Unless there is a sufficient reason to the contrary. This is the Escalona sufficient reason type test. A convicted defendant's complaint about the absence of a direct appeal, there's been no direct appeal, should always be brought before the defendant pursues any other collateral post-conviction action, and it should be brought by habeas petition. I'll give you the 3 reasons why I say this is the procedure to do this. Reinstatement of direct appeal on a successive collateral post-conviction action will nullify the first action. As in this case, Mr. Evans now has been able to go back, undo everything he did on his 974-06, and have the court look at it fresh. Without a good reason, this doesn't make sense. It causes the kind of confusion it does here. There's no reason why a defendant who does not have a right to counsel to bring a collateral post-conviction action, for example, a 974-06, that's up to him or her. There's no reason why the defendant, if the defendant truly felt that loss of direct appeal was that he lost the direct appeal because of what his appellate counsel did, dropping the ball, didn't do something, he or she wouldn't sit on it for that long a time, would ask the Court of Appeals to look at that issue first. And that's because, in part, the remedy is that if you don't have a direct appeal, you're losing the opportunity to present issues through counsel, or at least have a counsel review those issues. 974-06, to raise that, it's inconsistent with that proposition because there is no right to counsel. Excuse me one second. For all of those reasons, and as I said before, because the habeas procedure not only is recognized by this court in Knight, Flores, and Smalley, but it allows for the record to be developed on what happened with why there wasn't a direct appeal, what did counsel do or not do. It's logically the first step in the process. If the defendant's habeas claim that he was wrongly denied the right to direct appeal is correct, it's reinstated, he's got counsel, he starts fresh. If he's wrong, and this is where my second point comes in, this is where it gets a little tricky. We don't have, and we haven't had a case that's dealt with the situation of what is the defendant supposed to do if he wants to say, I lost direct appeal, because of ineffective appellate counsel. But I've also got a bunch of other constitutional issues I want to raise on 974-06. What is he supposed to do then? My suggestion is that he start in the Court of Appeals with a habeas petition alleging denial of direct appeal. That's the issue that the Court of Appeals should address first. In conjunction with that habeas petition, he should ask the Court of Appeals, tell the Court of Appeals, look, I've got these other issues that I want to raise with or without counsel that are constitutional in nature. So if you grant my habeas petition, my direct appeal is reinstated, these other issues go away, you don't have to look at them. If you deny my habeas petition and say that I would waive my right to direct appeal, essentially, then he's at least preserved those issues. They can be remanded to the trial court on 974-06 and proceed in the orderly fashion that's intended. That pretty much, I think, covers the procedural default.
How does the defendant know, particularly how does a pro se defendant know to do that?
That's a good question. I guess when the right to direct appeal is the defendant is told of those rights at sentencing. And if the defendant obtains appointed appellate counsel, as here, our case law says that it's the responsibility of appointed appellate counsel to make sure that the defendant understands that, you know, he's not going to get another attorney if he doesn't like the way counsel's doing it, that he understands that there's a no merit process, that he has the right to go pro se if he wants to. We don't have anything that, any case law that expands on disadvantages of going pro se. That's in the case law in Thornton, they talk about that. But I guess knowing whether or not to bring a habeas petition, it's just like knowing whether or not to bring a 974-06 motion. It's up to the defendant because there is no right on this collateral once it's final, once the appeal has lapsed. It's up to the defendant to make that kind of a claim. I think in this case, the equities are, I don't know if that's the right term, but certainly here, all the information that Mr. Evans had when the direct appeal lapsed suggests that he knew enough. If he really wanted a direct appeal, if he really felt that he'd been left in the dark here by counsel closing the file and he could have done something about it. I mean, he filed two extension motions on his own. Attorney Flood actually sent him a letter that's in the appendix to the state's brief, page 121, in which Attorney Flood told him, look, you're telling me you want to have hire your own counsel, but I don't want to give you the file until you do that so that in case you can't come up with that or you change your mind, I'm still going to be your attorney. And that letter confirms that he decided apparently not to take that risk and go ahead and proceed. And in the end, he ended up not hiring counsel and just did not file a notice of appeal.
In looking at 809-82, which is the rule under which the defendant proceeded, what, in the words of that rule, or in the comment thereunder, Judicial Council Committee notes, or anything looking at this, would preclude a defendant from proceeding the way that the defendant proceeded?
Not in the precise words, I would guess. Good cause is probably the operative phrase there, but I'm suggesting that when the underlying reason for the extension motion, for the 809-82 motion, the good cause, if you will, is ineffective appellate counsel, that our case law says that's the type of thing because of its loaded nature, substantive nature, that has to be addressed in a habeas, or should be addressed in a habeas petition. We don't have cases that say that's exclusive, but I'm suggesting that would solve the problem of the way this came in reversed order. Because what we're doing now is we're trying to undo the 974-06 motion, go back to direct appeal, and I mean that shouldn't be the way this should be done.
Isn't the gatekeeper the initial motion made in the Court of Appeals? I mean, as the motion for enlargement is made, it can be made, of course, on the court can do it on its own, period.
under 809.82. But if a party does it, then there has to be good cause shown. The Court of Appeals here, sitting in full panel, said, well, look, inherent in the decision of the one judge in granting it is that we take into consideration the length of time and whether it's unreasonable. And whether or not that length of time and what's alleged in the motion constitutes good cause.
Right.
And that makes sense to me. If I were sitting as a one panel, one judge on a case, like the Court of Appeals says here, you know, you want an enlargement of time? Well, how long have you waited? That's one of the things. And why have you waited? And then I determine if there's good cause and I grant it or not.
Right. No, I guess where the state's position here is that we would disagree that this is good, that a showing of good cause was made purely on the document that was filed, the motion to extend time, and that the Court of Appeals, I mean, the state's not blameless here. I mean,
that's the other reason why the Court of Appeals here says, hey, look, by the way, the state's not blameless either.
So. That's right. But the Court of Appeals did give us a chance to respond when we did call it to the court's attention. And all I can say on that topic is that I think the way it was captioned as an extension motion got the ball off on the wrong foot. I'm not saying that, you know, that an extension motion, good cause, isn't a vehicle that this could be raised on, but it's not really the proper way to do it because of the potential substantive stuff that goes into that when it's that kind of a claim. So even though the words of that 809.82 would allow for this under that good cause language, this is when it's the underlying claim is ineffective appellate counsel. That good cause should not have been determined without a response from the state solicited by the court.
When you get to the response from the state, you have a little difficulty because you said you didn't respond. I don't want to push you, so tell me if what I'm saying is accurate. What I hear you saying is, look, under the words of 809.82, the defendant can do what he did. But that's not really the best or the proper way that this underlying matter should be brought to the court.
That's correct.
Is that what you're saying?
That's right. That this isn't this type of a claim, because of its substantive nature, because of the types of defenses the state could raise, because of the typical need for an evidentiary hearing, that an affidavit isn't enough. In fact, in this case, Attorney Flood's affidavit says she didn't recall whether she advised him of the disadvantages she shot of proceeding pro se, I'm sorry. And, I mean, 4.5, 5, 6 years later, it's understandable that she wouldn't necessarily recall such a discussion. But it just seems to me that this is the type of thing that Knight took into account when Knight said, we're not going to bring ineffective appellate counsel claims in the trial court any longer on 974-06 motions. We're going to start in the Court of Appeals. And the reason is because the Court of Appeals then can look at this substantive claim and decide whether or not, I mean, either there's a waiver or there wasn't of a direct appeal when it's brought after the fact, after the appeal has lapsed.
The reason I prefaced my comment that I didn't want to push you, because I'm going to take you where I pushed you and
sure.
Now go one step further. And that is, regardless, I'm talking now about arguments generically. Give me any issue, I don't care, civil or criminal. And if I have two attorneys disagreeing on what a statute says, and I have one attorney that says, well, I know the statute says that, but it seems to me the better way to do it is this way, I'm going to say oftentimes, okay, it might be the better way, but it's not the required way, so for this case, I'm going to let the person follow the words of the statute the way they did it, and then write an opinion that says, from henceforth, the better way.
Sure.
Can you respond?
But see,
that?
We get to the same point. If, you know, the underlying claim is ineffective appellate counsel, loss of direct appeal. If it's raised by extension motion, if it's raised by habeas, the nature of whether that's good cause under the extension statute, whether it's a basis for habeas relief, the analysis of that underlying issue is still the same. So it seems to me you get there the same way. I'm just suggesting that the extension motion, and I'm speculating somewhat, but the fact that it's captioned as an extension motion when it's that long after the fact, when it's that type of a claim, and I go so far as to even speculate that perhaps the Court of Appeals in its one-line decision 2 days after the fact maybe didn't look closely at the underlying reasons either, but that those reasons need to be developed, and habeas, because of the way the supervisory writ process is set up, and because of the case law that talks about it, Flores and Knight, well, that's the way to do it.
But from now on, everybody's going to be more careful. The Court of Appeals is going to be more careful when it's labeled that way, because they know it might be a little more than just a technical extension. You're going to be more careful. I mean, your office is going to be more careful. All right. So it was done this way. People may have misread it. All right. Where does it get us? So everybody's was a little bad on the procedure, or a lot bad on the procedure. Defense counsel was, state was, Court of Appeals was. Okay, where are we now? I mean, we got a guy who says, hey, I got an unfair trial. That's what he's saying. Because 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So what do we do if everybody has somehow misstated the procedure or misinterpreted the procedure? This guy wants to get to the merits. Should we get to the merits? Or should we not get to the merits?
Well, we're saying not get to the merits.
And I assume that.
Yeah. But I'm also saying that even if this had been raised by a habeas petition instead of an extension motion,
right,
he's got a procedural default problem because he took a 97406 first. And just to
not the procedural problem. You got a guy representing himself, right? And so he takes a 97406. Now you're going to say, whoops, can't have a direct appeal and you can't have another 97406, so just sit there in prison even though you've got what you think is a meritorious defense. So that was the state's position, isn't it?
I don't think so. what I'm saying is there are a couple of ways why he shouldn't.
Even though you allege you have a meritorious defense, is that the state's position?
Right. I mean, there are alternative reasons why he should not get a new trial. One are these procedural reasons that we've been talking about. An alternative one is that his underlying claims lack merit. We're not trying to say. I mean, we want people to have an attorney and have their direct appeal. We're not trying to dodge that. We're just saying that when a defendant chooses to take some other method first, you've got a good record here that shows that he knew what the direct appeal process was all about. He tried to do it and then gave it up. That he doesn't have good reason here. He's not like somebody else who has done nothing and suddenly discovers that he doesn't have his direct appeal and maybe we're 11 or 12 months out. Now he's coming back and saying, I thought my appellate attorney was going to do something. That's not this case. But the last alternative would be on the merits.
Okay. Your time is going to run out, too.
Do you want me to talk about the merits?
I would, unless you really have something else that you want to say on the procedure or someone else would like to question you on that.
Sure. The key issue, again, and the one that, if you get past the procedural problems here, would be the lesser-included offense instruction, which is attempted homicide conviction was reversed. The question there is, was there, and I think the operative and key word here is appreciable evidence, to allow jurors to conclude that if Evans was the shooter, and he said he wasn't, that's what his trial stance was, that he did not intend to kill Derek Devine. In other words, was there appreciable evidence negating the element of intent? And we say no for a variety of reasons. Because Evans claimed he wasn't the shooter, the only evidence on the shooter's intent is going to come from the physical evidence and from the accounts of the victim or the eyewitnesses. This is what those accounts and evidence show. The shooter fired 4 to 6 shots at the victim, Derek Devine, in rapid succession at close range, hitting him in 4 locations: the left buttock and the left hip, the upper and lower left leg, and the right bicep. the large number of shots at close range and the wound locations all over the body suggest that the only reasonable inference is that the shooter was intending to kill his victim, not merely to cause life-threatening wounds to the victim. The trial court correctly denied the lesser instruction. And rhetorically, I guess the way this might be played out, and as I've argued in the brief, how could the shooter, Evans or whoever it was, possibly guarantee that any particular wound, any one of these 4 to 6 shots, would not cause the victim to bleed to death? How could they guarantee that he might not instantaneously move a fraction of an inch and take one to a vital body part, the head or the heart? There was no testimony that Evans was a marksman, for example. I mean, if he wanted to pursue an alternative defense even if he was the shooter, I didn't intend to kill him, there's no testimony that he...
Suppose this was a case where you have a law enforcement officer who is using deadly force, but is using it just to stop the guy, not kill him. What would your argument be then?
Well, he's probably not committed any crime. I mean,
put it in a discipline case.
I'm not sure.
You have a situation where somebody does something, and you're saying the only reasonable inference from shooting at close range and not hitting a vital organ is you intended to hit a vital organ and kill him. You're absolutely right. You could hit somebody in the arm, and they could bleed to death. They could be a fast bleeder and not get to them. That's not the only intent.
Sure. I don't disagree that there is that inference that there was no intent, but that's not enough because there wasn't appreciable evidence of that. The only evidence that would negate intent would be, or the only evidence that even that gets to the fact that Evans was the shooter in terms of that alternative defense was, he told a police officer that he thought the victim was pulling a gun. But it seems to me that if the jury accepts that, there's no way they would accept that he was just trying to recklessly fire back and risk being shot to death himself if what he was doing was, in effect, acting in self-defense. So I'm arguing that the trial court here, the evidence was not appreciable enough to let the jury decide on the lesser included reckless endangering safety. I also would point out, just on the evidence on this point also, that the victim here, he was shot through the right bicep, and one of the witnesses said that he was shielding his face and his upper body. So, again, additional evidence that this was really, he was fortunate, not that he was, not that the shooter was trying to miss him or just nick him or whatever you want to call it, that this was, in fact, an intent to kill. I see my time's running down, and I just would like to get to a harmless error argument that would kind of encompass the rest of these issues. In a nutshell, Evans' two issues are that his alibi witnesses should have been presented, or his putative alibi witnesses should have been presented. And the other issue that all the arguments go to is that his confession should, or his admissions to the police should not have come in. Assuming, for the sake of argument, that he's right on the merits of that the evidence, alibi people should have testified, confession or admission should have been kept out. State's position, in that alternative, is that it would be harmless error or not deficient or not prejudice on the ineffective counsel prong. First, Evans identified no specific witness that would say he was specifically someplace else. And jurors did, in fact, hear Evans' own alibi testimony that he was not the shooter. Second, misidentification was not a viable defense. The victim personally knew Evans from the neighborhood for about 2 years. He had just spoken to Evans on the street a few seconds before the shooting. A few minutes earlier had seen him on the way to the store. The shooter was only a few feet away. This was not a bystander's brief glimpse of an unknown perpetrator at a distance. This was a face-to-face encounter between two people who knew one another.
Wasn't there a bystander who testified?
There was an independent witness who saw part of the shooting, at least, right.
And the two disagreed about the color of his jacket?
Well, not totally. The bystander, the independent witness, said it was a yellow jacket, or might have said leather jacket. And
what about the hair?
And the victim, they both said he had long hair, not wearing a hat, the shooter. And
didn't one say he was wearing a hat?
I'm sorry?
Didn't one say he was wearing a hat?
I don't think so. I don't recall that.
Is it curly versus straight?
Straight long hair, kind of long between shoulder and or shoulder length. Excited utterance situation here. After the four gunshots, someone came to the victim's aid on the street. The victim said, "Macho shot me." And the person that was coming to the aid knew that the defendant's name, nickname was, in fact, Macho. At the hospital, again, the victim gave the same account. And finally, on the harmless error argument, Evans' consciousness of guilt is reflected in the fact that he had eluded police for 3 weeks after the shooting, was found hiding under a blanket behind an air conditioner and some boxes in his mother's basement. And I guess unless there's other questions, I think I've covered mostly what I wanted to say.
Thank you, Mr. Farley.
Thank you.
Mr. Hennick?
Yes, 1.5 minutes. First of all, the fact that the shooter could not guarantee that the victim would not be killed is why this is reckless disregard, not why it's intentional. In terms of harmless error, Derek Devine, the victim, testified that the shooter had a yellow leather three-quarter length jacket. Daniel Kelly, the independent eyewitness, said that he was wearing a blue and yellow Michigan jacket. Devine said that the shooter was not wearing a hat. Dan Kelly said that he was wearing a hat. Devine said that the shooter had shoulder-length straight hair. Devine said that it was curly hair. Kelly said it was curly hair. Devine said that he fell to the ground upon being shot. Daniel Kelly said he never fell to the ground. Devine said that the shooter was there with a companion, so that there were a total of three people on the street. Daniel Kelly said there was only the shooter and Mr. Devine. Mr. Devine says that Evans shot him, and Mr. Kelly across the street couldn't identify Evans as being the person who shot him. Given that, there is every reason to believe that a jury could have discounted Mr. Devine's testimony or identification testimony as the result of shock, having just been shot four times, not intentionally lying, but mistaken. We also have Evans' own testimony that he was somewhere else at the time. It was not inherently incredible. A jury easily could have believed that. The jury easily could have believed that Detective Jones was not being credible when he stated that Evans had made this statement. And a jury easily could have believed, as this court said in Burroughs, that if a defendant doesn't bring in the people who he was with, who he says he was with, that he must be lying about it. So there is a very serious prejudice resulting from the exclusion of those witnesses. And the state simply cannot, submit that there was, beyond a reasonable doubt, this was harmless. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both for well-done arguments on a case that raises both procedural and substantive issues. So we close our hearing on 02-1869-CR, State v. Evans, and our thanks to Attorney Hennick and Freimuth for making their presentations this morning away from the court's home. Anyway, we are in recess. We're going